They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The corporate side of Chinese cybercrime on the broadcast today. Beer as well. And is that a lithium-ion battery in your pocket or... you know what? Never mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday. It's the last day of January 2013. Good as always to have you with us. So it turns out it wasn't just the New York Times. The Wall Street Journal reported today that its own computers had been infiltrated by Chinese hackers as well. Apparently, the paper said to keep an eye on its China coverage. And it's also not just media companies that are getting the unwanted online attention. You know, Kim Zetter covers cybersecurity for Wired magazine. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So we know what they wanted out of the New York Times. They were looking for email addresses and contacts and all that stuff. But as you broaden it to corporations, what do presumably overseas hackers want out of American companies?
Well, they want a variety of things. In this particular case, as you pointed out, they wanted to get source information for some stories that the New York Times was publishing. But we've seen multiple attacks, and the motivations and aims are often different. A couple of years ago, they hacked Google, and there the focus was getting into the email accounts of political activists, but also obtaining source code belonging to Google. So in that case, we've got a political motive and possibly an economic motive.
And then as you spread the corporate net more widely, they have gone after companies like Lockheed Martin, a big defense contractor, and you can sort of imagine what they might want out of them. But what about, like, Coke? Apparently Coke has been victimized. What do you want out of Coke?
Well, you want, and there again, it's a sort of economic espionage. You want to know what your competitors are doing. You might not necessarily focus on the recipe for Coke, although that's a good one. Everyone wants to know the recipe for Coke, right? But you might also want to know the factory secrets. You know, how does Coke operate successfully?
What about car companies? I could see car companies, right? Because, I mean, China is so big in the car industry.
Yeah. I mean, so in there, you'd want to do some espionage on how the layout of the plant works, who their suppliers are, maybe, you know, how everything works. You might want to set up to model their assembly lines, that kind of thing. Yeah.
This is, I will grant you in advance of the question, a monstrous oversimplification. But don't any of these places that have been attacked have, like, Norton antivirus installed?
Yeah, but that's not going to help you.
Okay. I mean, you see my point, right?
I see your point, yeah. Okay. You know, getting security right is difficult. It's a really hard thing to do, and it's an ongoing thing. You can't just secure a system for once and say, okay, we're done, no hackers are going to get in. You have to constantly be monitoring, and you have to have multiple defense layers, not just antivirus. You need firewalls, you need intrusion detection and intrusion prevention. So we do a lot of blame game when someone gets hacked, but it's really hard to get it right. In this case, you know, there probably were a lot of things that the New York Times could have done better. But quite often, you can actually do everything right and still get hacked.
Well, yeah. Is this fundamentally a game in which the attacker will always have the upper hand, right?
Yeah, because there are multiple ways to get in, and you never know what they are. Some of them are novel, and you don't know about them. For instance, with zero-day attacks, which use a vulnerability that no one knows about.
I'm sorry, zero-day?
Yeah, a zero-day is attacking a vulnerability that's unknown. For instance, if you're attacking a vulnerability in a Windows operating system, Microsoft doesn't know about it yet, so it hasn't been fixed. So those are things that are really hard to catch.
That's positively Rumsfeldian. It's an unknown unknown.
It's an unknown unknown, exactly.
So where do we go? I mean, is this just the cost of life in the digital era?
It's the cost of being online, definitely. I mean, if you're connected, you're hackable. So, what everyone has to do is figure out how to sort of mitigate the risks and then how to live in a sustainable way with the risks. So you know you're going to get hacked, and you try to do the best that you can to mitigate what the consequences of that will be.
Kim Zetter, she's a senior reporter at Wired. Kim, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me.
A bouncy ride today at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Beer, as you may have noticed, is getting bigger. Mergers and acquisitions have brought us to the point where just a couple of companies control most of the name brands. Anheuser-Busch InBev, which is the world's biggest brewer, had been hoping to get even bigger by spending $20 billion to buy Mexico's Grupo Modelo, which makes Corona, among other things. Today, the Justice Department said, hang on just a second. It's got antitrust concerns about the deal. Beer drinkers, though, have some taste concerns, as Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
When InBev took over the German import Beck's, it moved the production of the lager from Germany to the United States, and it made changes to the recipe to lower production costs.
So what they tend to do is hone down the brewing process such that it costs them less to produce the same beverage.
Matt Simpson is known as the beer sommelier. He writes about beer and taught a beer education class at Emory University. He says there are consequences to cutting costs.
There's less flavor, there's less body, and often there's less alcohol.
Immediately, customers started complaining about the blander Beck's, and sales dropped. But overall, InBev's strategy has paid off. The company has 39% of U.S. beer sales. If it acquires Grupo Modelo, it would jump to 46%.
The U.S. beer market is essentially duopoly now.
Peter Reed is the publisher of Modern Brewery Age. The other company in that duopoly is Miller Coors, which has 26% of the market.
Basically, in terms of the overall market, Anheuser-Busch, in most markets, they're the price leader.
Eric Shepard is the executive director of Beer Marketers Insights. He says when InBev increases prices, Miller Coors tends to follow, but Modelo doesn't. By not raising its prices, it hopes to narrow the price gap between its more expensive Corona and Budweiser. That price competition, the Justice Department fears, could vanish if InBev owns both brands. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
On prices, by the way, the tweet of the day today came from Benjamin Applebaum at the New York Times. Government goes to court to keep beer cheap, he said. All right, moving on now to the perils of celebrity endorsements. They have always been risky because celebrities drive drunk, they shoplift, and they live under a microscope. You throw Twitter and social media into that mix, and it only gets worse. Case in point, BlackBerry. Pop star Alicia Keys added some pizzazz to the big reveal of the BlackBerry 10 yesterday as the company's new global creative director, whatever that means. Problem is, she was tweeting just a couple of days earlier from her iPhone. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports now on the hazards of dealing with celebs in the digital age.
Alicia Keys loves the new BlackBerry 10.
I love the new browser. It's super fast. I love the hub. I love the camera. It's great. And I definitely love how you can switch from work to play mode through balance. I love that.
That's a whole lot of love, considering Keys was in a relationship with another smartphone just a few days earlier. One of her 11 million followers on Twitter noticed she'd been posting from an iPhone.
The first thing I thought was, oh boy.
Chris Azizos is president and founder of LiveWire Media Relations. She says managing celebrity endorsements was easier in the old days when you worried mainly about DUIs and extramarital affairs.
Today, celebrities have this instantaneous access to their fan base.
Where companies can't control what they say, and it's possible to see which gadget they're using to say it. Tim Calkins teaches marketing at Northwestern University.
Now everybody can check and verify what people are doing. So in this case, you know, somebody says, oh, they'll be the new spokesperson, but then very quickly you find out that maybe that isn't quite as robust an endorsement as you thought it was going to be.
As Oprah found out when she tweeted her love for Microsoft's new Surface tablet from her iPad. Of course, sometimes when celebrity endorsers have trouble being exclusive, it doesn't take social media to discover it. Last year, Brazilian soccer star Ronaldinho lost a lucrative deal with Coca-Cola when he showed up to a press conference drinking a Pepsi. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
You know that indicator on your cell phone, the one that tells you the percentage of battery life you have left? I finally had to turn mine off because it was making me crazy with all its constant changes, which says a little bit about me and a little bit about how much we depend on batteries now. Phones, laptops, Boeing Dreamliners. So we figured this was a good time for some Battery 101 with Scott Tong at the Sustainability Desk.
In our mobile lives today, we forget all the progress in the battery kitchen that got us here. Seth Fletcher at Popular Science is the author of Bottled Lightning.
For most of the 20th century, battery science progressed really slowly. In part, that was because it was kind of a backwater.
And the science is really hard, especially the chemistry of batteries.
They almost drove Thomas Edison crazy. He spent about a decade trying to develop a new type of battery, which he ultimately did.
Fletcher says research took off in the 1960s and 70s. Smog and traffic jammed L.A., and the oil shocks for the whole country made it a priority to get us off petroleum. Several companies tested lithium. It's light, packs lots of energy, but it isn't always stable.
After the ExxonMobil company had blown up a couple of labs, they decided to get out of the energy business.
That's battery pioneer John Goodenough at the University of Texas. Now 90 years old, he gets the National Medal of Science tomorrow at the White House. His breakthrough was making an essential piece of the lithium-ion battery, the stable electrode.
And that gave you the energy density that you needed to have a handheld device, and that led to the wireless revolution.
Now, here's the funny thing. Henry Ford owned a car. Edison owned a light bulb. John Goodenough?
I don't have an iPhone. I'm an old-fashioned conservative gentleman who finds that I get along perfectly well with the last century's technology.
He doesn't like phone calls. Another paradox, Goodenough's invention isn't always for the good.
You take the cell telephone. Well, it can be used to detonate a roadside bomb from the hillside. It may be in the hands of evil people.
Since its breakthrough, lithium-ion batteries have seen incremental improvements. There is a limit to the architecture, though. To make electric cars mainstream or store lots of wind energy, it'll take another leap forward.
And then I'm going to do something that every chemistry teacher in America will tell you not to do.
Steven Visco is working on that. He runs battery startup Poly Plus in Berkeley, California. His cocktail combines lithium and water. Now, normally,
it's typically a spark, and that ignites the hydrogen, and you get a little bit of a Hindenburg there. I mean, it's a lot of excitement.
Visco has a way to de-Hindenburg it and pack more energy into a little space. It may take a decade to commercialize, but think of the payoff.
Once you get those products to market, they tend to never go away. And that's precisely why when you open the hood of your car, you see a lead acid battery. Well, it's 150 years old.
Now, the nature of energy is each step forward tends to come with a trade-off. James Bellingham studies batteries at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute.
Every time you move the energy density up, you know, you bring with that some element of risk. And just think about gasoline. I mean, how many times in a movie a car crashes and there's a little fire and everyone runs away from the car because they're afraid the gasoline will blow up? Batteries can have their bad days also.
The battery chase goes on, though. And at 90, John Goodenough is still in the game. Why? For the reason he joined it decades ago, to graduate us from fossil fuels.
Otherwise, we have Easter Island. We'll end up with a bunch of stones on the island that says man once lived here, but they used up everything that was there, then they killed one another for whatever was left until there was nothing left but stones.
In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, the middle manager's oath.
If an important executive disagrees with something I say, I will apologize for my choice of words and then rephrase it in a way that makes it seem like we were actually in agreement all along.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 49 points today, a third of 1%, ended at 13,860. The NASDAQ closed pretty much where it started, 3142. The S&P 500 dipped 3 points, a quarter percent, finished at 1498. But my, oh my, what a January it was. For the month, the Dow rose nearly 6%. The NASDAQ added 4%. The S&P 500 bulked up 5%. That DOJ beer buzzkill we mentioned earlier cost Anheuser-Busch InBev some suds. Shares fizzled 6% today. Suds, I like that. BlackBerry continued to take a drubbing a day after unveiling two new smartphones meant to save the company. Shares powered down 5.8% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. How many folks started off 2013 with a new job? In Washington, the Labor Department releases its employment report for January. The Commerce Department reports on construction spending for December. And February is Library Lovers Month. Go hug your library. Buy it some flowers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so do this for me as I set up this next piece, would you? If you're at a computer, and if you're not, just play along like you are, try Googling something. Say, Ben Bernanke. You'll notice that the first thing that pops up is his Wikipedia entry, information written by us, regular people. Although, to be clear, the number of users who write and edit actively on Wikipedia is pretty small, about 15,000 or so. But Wikipedia is brought to us by the Wikimedia Foundation. Sue Gardner is the executive director, and she is the lucky winner on today's installment of Conversations from the Corner Office. Sue, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You know, so it occurred to me as I was thinking about talking to you that you guys and public radio kind of have a similar business model, right? You create all this content, and then you have to go out and ask for money to help support it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, it's funny. I come from the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Oh, yeah.
And it was funny that I did make my way to a kind of NPR-esque model. It's different from the CBC, but it's how American public broadcasters support them. Yeah, we just ask people who like us to give us money.
How's it working for you? I mean, how much time do you spend out there, you know, on the hustings, as it were?
It's fantastic. Practically none. I mean, it's amazing. We do an annual campaign every winter. And this year we made $2.7 million a day, up from $430,000 a day last year. So it's going really, really well.
You totally need to call your local public radio station.
Yeah, we're in touch.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia.org homepage here in the studio as we're talking. And, you know, it's the one that lists all the various languages that you guys have Wikipedias in. And it is, first of all, overwhelmingly English, overwhelmingly Western, not a whole lot of minority representation there. I mean, what are you guys doing to sort of broaden the bandwidth, as it were, of Wikipedia and what you guys do?
Yeah, Wikipedia is actually available in 286 languages, right? So it's pretty much available in every language that is spoken by a reasonably large number of people around the world. I mean, it's available in languages like Cree, for example. But you're right when you say that English is the most edited, right? And yeah. People in developing countries tend to be disproportionately editors. But still, we aspire to broaden out the diversity of the folks who are contributing to Wikipedia so that it will be better and richer and stronger and smarter and more useful for people.
Here's another problem for you guys. And you wrote this in an op-ed in the LA Times the other day. 9 out of 10 Wikipedians, as you call them, are men, which can't be good for diversity.
Yeah, it's not good at all. It's actually the single thing that kind of troubles me most about our editing community, right? It stems from, I think, the origins of the project. So when people were first interacting online in 2001, the folks who were interacting online tended to skew heavily, heavily male. So we started there. So we badly want to recruit more women. We have a number of activities designed to do it.
Here's another thing that will appeal to the public radio aficionado in you and the sensitivity of what I'm about to talk about. When are you going to start putting ads on Wikipedia to pay for things?
Sorry, what?
When are you going to start putting ads, or as we call them in public radio, underwriting on Wikipedia to start paying for things?
When are we going to start doing that?
Yeah.
We're never going to do that.
Never. Never's a long time, Sue.
Yeah, and we do hedge a tiny little bit, right? Like if it were a choice of putting ads on Wikipedia or shutting down Wikipedia, we would then very reluctantly consider putting ads on Wikipedia. But we're never going to get there, right? Because, you know, the world has changed so much, and today it's possible for people to donate online really easily using PayPal or whatever, right? Kickstarter works that way. Donors Choose works that way. We work that way. That wasn't possible 20 years ago. But today, I mean, we can see in our steeply soaring revenue, which is fantastic, right? People love Wikipedia. They give us $30 on average. Some people give us a lot more. Some people give us less. That model totally works.
Last question, and then I'll let you go. What are you going to do? I don't know if you have kids or not, but what are you going to do when your 10-year-old comes to you working on a school project and says, hey, Mom, I saw this on Wikipedia. It must be true, and I'm just going to put it in my paper.
Everybody should be skeptical of everything that they read, right? It's like everybody's saying, you know, be skeptical of Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. That is true. They should also be skeptical of everything, right? We should all be critical consumers of the media.
Sue Gardner, she's the executive director of the Wikimedia Foundation. Sue, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
A brief detour into etymology might be handy right about here, specifically the derivation of the word credit, as in credit card. It's from the Latin originally, creditum, something entrusted to another, a loan. In other words, something you have to pay back. That meaning appears to be lost on some members of the millennial generation, though, whose relationship with their credit card debt is decidedly different from the norm. Audrey Quinn reports.
If you want to talk to someone about credit card debt, talk to April Lesho. She's had her fair share, and she's got the collection of financial planning books to prove it.
Let's see. Here's this one. Yeah, Debt-Free by 30. This is actually the first one that I ever read. Susie Orman, The 9 Steps to Financial Freedom. Idiot's Guide to 401k Plans.
Those books seem to have worked for Lesho. She's now the proud new owner of a house in Washington, D.C. But she hasn't always been so careful with money.
By the end of college, I had about $30,000 in debt. I mean, I spent at will. So, you know, if I felt like taking a trip, I took a trip. If I felt like getting a new stereo system, I did.
This was at the University of South Carolina, where Lesho graduated in 2001 with a degree in sociology.
Didn't you think it was going to catch up with you someday?
Well, I just figured when I got a job, I would, you know, be able to pay that off. I didn't realize how far behind I was getting and how long it would actually take to climb my way out of it.
You know, for a sociology degree, $30,000 sounds about right.
That's Lucia Dunn. She's a professor of economics at Ohio State University. She says the scary thing is that Lesho's circumstances are pretty typical for millennials coming out of college.
They just have a lot more debt than previous generations had.
Dunn recently published a study on how people manage their credit card debt. She found that younger people today are also paying that debt back at much slower rates than previous generations.
And based on what young people are telling us, if we project that out to the end of their life using life expectancy tables, we will see that they will die with credit card debt.
Dunn calls that taking debt to your grave, and her study finds millennials aren't paying back debt the way the current credit card system expects them to. They just keep racking up more debt.
I think we're going to see that the banks have to tighten up. So it could mean that credit is harder to come by. You know, you could predict a doomsday scenario and say, well, at some point there's just going to be a big crash in the credit card market.
But Dunn found an easy way to get people to pay off their debt faster. Right now, credit card companies have really low minimum monthly payments. Dunn saw that when companies raise those minimums, even just slightly, people seem to pay back an even higher amount.
So when you begin to raise the rate on people, it sends a message that, you know, you got to take this debt seriously.
She says banks will have to make those kind of rate changes soon, and that could prevent the kind of credit disaster we've been talking about. I asked April Lesho if higher payments would have made a difference for her debt-wise.
I think so, probably in the beginning, because I would have been held accountable for it earlier on, because it was just too easy. Getting in debt was just way too easy.
Lesho finally managed to pay off her debt in 2009. She says she actually still uses a credit card today in order to take advantage of reward points. But this time around, she pays off her credit card balance every month. From Washington, D.C., I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
If you work in an office, chances are you've run into one. There are TV shows about them. There are movies about them. And there are definitely horror stories about them. I'm talking middle managers here, people, the ones who have just enough power to be really annoying. That's why an item we saw in McSweeney's the other day caught our eye. It's called The Middle Manager's Oath. And I would tell you who wrote it, but he's a little bit afraid of his middle manager. So here you go.
I will challenge my employees to find solutions to the problems I unnecessarily created for them. Because I have no life outside of work, I will expect the same of my team. I will take credit for any project I named. If an important executive disagrees with something I say, I will apologize for my choice of words and then rephrase it in a way that makes it seem like we were actually in agreement all along. I will never contradict myself. I will sometimes contradict myself. I will often contradict you, usually in front of your clients, and then pretend to take a call on my phone while you handle damage control. I will drop names. I will drop them like they're hot. I will reward members of my team for good work with praise and other non-monetary forms of positive reinforcement. Examples of good work include responding to emails on weekends and agreeing with something I say in large group meetings. One of my opinions is worth three of your facts. I will be reliably late to meetings which I myself called and tagged on your calendar as urgent and then need to leave early, preventing anything from being accomplished. I will become diabolically drunk with the slightest sip of power. I will form a super exclusive club with other middle managers where we only eat lunch with each other, share all sorts of inside jokes, require an elaborate secret handshake to enter each other's offices, and wear matching rings which, when touched together, turn us into a single, giant super manager with unlimited budget approval powers. But if a promotion opens up, I will stab them in the back in a heartbeat.
The Middle Manager's Oath was originally published in McSweeney's. We've got a link to it at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a somewhat out-of-the-ordinary help-wanted ad from the state of Washington, where marijuana, you might remember, is now legal. The State Liquor Control Board up there needs an official marijuana consultant to advise on the finer points of all things cannabis. 5 years regulatory experience desired, law degree preferred, no indication of whether a criminal record is disqualifying. But you can just hear the job interview, right? Dude. Come on. Totally. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 49 points, about a third percent. The NASDAQ closed right where it started. The S&P 500 dipped 3 points, a quarter percent. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.